As a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, beautiful teen growing up on Long Island, Fern Kupfer could never have foreseen the many paths her life would lead her on. In her memoir, she connects the past with the present. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, a rebroadcast of my conversation with Fern Kupfer. Her memoir is Leaving Long Island and Other Departures. We'll talk about her life and how her family's past is with her every day. Just over 4 years ago, she discovered that she carried the BRCA1 gene. That means she inherited a high risk for breast and or ovarian cancer. I'll talk with her about how that felt and the decisions it led to. Join the conversation after the news. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is author Fern Kupfer. She lives in Ames, and she's a retired professor of English at Iowa State University, as well as the author of a number of books. Her latest book is Leaving Long Island and Other Departures. It's a memoir that connects the past with the present. It connects the lives of her grandparents and great-grandparents with the challenges that Fern and possibly her offspring face today. Hello, Fern.
Hi, good morning. It's very cozy in this station.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks.
And you have written a great deal about your life over the years. Most famously, you've written about your son who had a genetic disorder and died very young. And we'll talk more about him as the hour goes on. But what made you think that it was time to, again, look at your life and write about what was going on with you?
Well, first I want to say I'm not so crazy about writing. I'm not a writer who has to write. And if someone said, oh, you know, you don't have to ever write again in your life, that would be okay with me. But I think when you have a story you really want to tell someone, that's important. And that's why I started, that's why I became a writer, was writing about Zach. I had to do that. And then much later in my life, when I was in my 60s, and I was diagnosed with the BRCA gene, again, I felt compelled that I had to write. Now, I want to say in the middle of that, I wrote three kind of B-minus novels, which I didn't have to write, and, you know, I kind of did since I taught writing, and it seemed like I should do that. but the first book I ever wrote, Before and After Zechariah, and this, was important. It's nonfiction. It was a story to tell. It was my story to tell. And I wanted to reach out and tell other people about it, that they weren't alone.
And although this is a book that focuses on the last couple of decades, really, in your life, and by last, I mean most recent, of course, you do start with your childhood on Long Island. And maybe you could read a little bit from the book to give us an introduction.
Sure, I would. You know, when you write nonfiction, when you write a memoir, it's how you organize it. It's not really linear. And so you go back and forth and then you say, oh, did I say this already? And the quality of writing is, you know, sometimes it could be confusing because your life, you know, you lead your life in a linear way. But part of what memoir is memories and how they come to you. And so I'm gonna begin with this. And we moved from the Bronx to Long Island, as people say, Long Island. And this is at the beginning on page 14. Time meanders. A crazy river, but I'll start here. When I was 10 years old, my parents' younger brother and I moved to Plainview, Long Island. It was 1956, and getting out of the city was something parents wanted to do for their children. Fresh air, grass, better schools. Long Island was the promised land for my parents' generation. In suburbia, in the 50s and early 60s, we had it good. Never before had American Jews enjoyed so much financial and personal security. Look how far we had come from a tenement to a three-bedroom split level with 2.5 baths. Look how far we were from the devastation of the Holocaust. How finally, after assimilation, it was easy to be ourselves, from the shtetl to success, from pogroms to prosperity. Suburbia seemed rural then. Put your shoes on, Ma. We're going into town, when we picked up my father from the Long Island Railroad. Wives put on fresh lipstick and moved over to the passenger's seat when the men, all in hats and dark suits, newspapers rolled under their arms, emerged from the train. Plainview, Long Island. I was afraid, walking home from school, I would not be able to find my way. The streets all looked alike. So did the houses. Suburban mothers waited in their brand-new kitchens with the latest appliances. My mother actually wore a frilly apron over her dress and had a snack ready for me. Up and down the blocks, other children were similarly greeted. After my grandmother died, my grandfather, Papa, came to live with us, having his own room in what other suburban families called the den. Even in winter, he sat on a lawn chair in the driveway, smoking a cigar, so far from the old world. There was my papa, sitting in the driveway in Plainview. Cleo, our family dog, lay at his feet. She was an odd spaniel dachshund mix. When I was in junior high, we rescued her from the Bidawi, home of abandoned pups. "Roll over and I'll pet you," my grandfather commanded. Cleo obeyed, staying still until Papa got tired of rubbing her tummy. "To be in America," he would declare, "even a dog is lucky." When school let out at 3 o'clock, Papa walked to meet me. I remember my grandfather in his long blue overcoat walking up Pasadena Drive, Jamaica Avenue, Oak Drive, looking like some old-world Tevye lost in the maze of suburban streets. Papa met me at school to carry my books home. "Lass mir tragen," he'd command in Yiddish. "Give it here." I begged my mother, "Can't you keep Papa in the house?" Apparently, she could not. I walked home from sixth grade with my friends, followed by a gaunt old Jewish man carrying a pink loose-leaf notebook.
You make Long Island at that time sound almost like a paradise or like Pleasantville in the movie from a few years ago. I mean, you do talk about you had friends who had families that were not so peaceful and so happy as yours was. But it sure gives us the impression of a very happy, secure childhood.
Well, suburbia got a really bad rap because, you know, and certainly by the time we were teenagers, we rolled our eyes like teenagers all over, you know, this country do, and we said how bored we were. But in fact, it was a very healthy time. This was before drugs. This was before technology. We walked to everyone's house. We had grass. You know, we came from the city where, you know, we had some trees in the house. We had parks, certainly. But everyone over landscaped in suburbia. Long Island is kind of flat, like Iowa, and it had been agricultural. They grew potatoes there. And so there were these fields and fields where, you know, then they built houses. And, you know, we played in these fields where there was construction. You know, later that we knew that one of the cancer correlations is those everything was sprayed with DDT in those days. And, you know, kids were playing among them. There's a very high cancer concentration on Long Island. But it was a fairly idyllic time to grow there.
You talk about your grandfather living with you. And throughout the book, you include pictures of your grandparents, even of your great-grandparents. And I love the picture you include of your grandma and grandpa, Papa Louis or Louis. And Grandma Celia. And, oh, that's such a wonderful picture because so many pictures from this time, and this was taken in 1912, the people in the picture have absolutely no facial expressions. You know, the holding is still. But your grandmother looks like she has a lot of personality.
She might have had too much personality. She really didn't know him that well. She had had an arranged marriage in Europe, and I had put that in the book, and it was not with my papa. And she told her mother, she was 16, and she told her mother, "You marry him, I'm going to America." She didn't like, he was too short. She didn't like the way the groom looked. And my papa was a man from her village, and then she brought him here to this country. She was here first as a brother. And so
she sponsored him as a member of her family.
Yes, because she didn't want to sponsor him as a fiancé. She didn't want to necessarily marry him. And then she did. And, it was we have to have a place to sleep, and there weren't enough rooms in the tenement, and that's why she married him. And he was a very, very kind and nice man. And she was a bit of a handful, I think.
When you were growing up in this sort of idyllic suburban community, did you know a lot about the old world and where your grandparents had come from?
Oh, yes. I grew up in a storytelling family, although my grandfather would say it was mostly women who talked. I knew about their villages. I knew about the arranged marriages. I knew about the food, and I knew about the poverty. I didn't know as a child the bad stuff. I didn't know about the Holocaust. I didn't know about the pogroms. And I remember when my grandfather was in his 80s, he fell, and he hit his head on the curb. My grandfather was very afraid of policemen because in Eastern Europe, policemen were really part of the problem. When there were pogroms, they either participated or watched. When people came into the villages and Jews were killed and their houses were burned. And so he was very afraid of authority and policemen. And when he fell, it was a young cop on Long Island who took him, put him in the ambulance, saw him in the hospital later. And I remember my papa saying over and over again to my mother, that policeman, he treated me like a brother. He treated me like a brother. And he was very, very shocked by that.
When did you find out about the Holocaust and what all of your many extended family relatives, part of your family was from Bialystok in Poland, which had a huge, thriving Jewish community, and then it was completely destroyed?
I think in the 50s, nobody wanted to be too Jewish. We were assimilated. We were American. They didn't talk about the Holocaust. Maybe I learned it in school. I don't remember it, but I certainly never knew what happened to my family. I know that there was family that ended up in Australia. They ended up in different places. My grandfather sent money to cousins in Australia for years, but I didn't know what happened to them. When my cousin, as a grown-up in her 60s, went to Bialystok, she did investigation. There was an uprising there, and they had rounded up all the Jews there and put them in a synagogue, and the synagogue was burned. And my cousin called and said, that could have been the family pictures that we had.
Wow. I'm talking with Fern Kupfer. Her most recent book is Leaving Long Island and Other Departures, a memoir. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. Fern Kupfer is a retired professor of English from Iowa State University. She lives in Ames. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. This is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Fern Kupfer. She's an author, and she's a retired English professor at Iowa State University. Her latest book is Leaving Long Island and Other Departures. It's a memoir. And Fern, we've been focusing on this early part of your life and your relationship with your family and your ancestors. And, of course, one of the reasons you wrote so much about your family is they not only shaped you as the woman you are, but also gave you a genetic destiny as well.
Yeah. The emotional shaping was better than, I guess, the physical shaping. Yeah. I had two genes that caused my son to have Canavan's disease, which is linked also to a Jewish ancestry, and it's very similar to Tay-Sachs. And that was the first book that I wrote. It was called Before and After Zachariah, and I wrote about him. He passed away when he was 16. He would have been 37 next year. And I wrote about what happens to a family when you have a very damaged child and residential placement. And then it changed my life. It was really the best thing I ever did. And I started talking to all families who have handicapped, disabled children, and the need for care and what we all need. And I was a public spokesperson for so many years for families. And after Zaki passed away, I felt I couldn't do that anymore. I didn't feel legitimate in doing that. Many years later, I was diagnosed with the BRCA1 gene. And this is a genetic predisposition to breast and ovarian cancer. There's all sorts of mutations, BRCA1 and BRCA2. I, again, have a gene that's endemic to the Ashkenazi Jewish population. About 40, what, I think it's 1 in 40 Jewish women carry this gene. And so then I began to write about that and the decisions I had to make.
What led to your getting tested for the BRCA1 gene?
Well, I thought I would always get breast cancer. I thought in my life I would get breast cancer. And so
And why did you think that?
Well, because my mother had breast cancer. Both my grandmothers had breast cancer. My aunt had breast cancer. And my cousin had breast cancer. And I did not have a sister. And I knew that the family connections and ramifications. But, you know, I was very careful. I was scrupulous in having mammographies and going to the doctor. And I thought, well, I would watch it. And then I was in my 60s and I thought, okay, I bit this bullet.
Right.
It was a small percentage of people who would not get breast cancer. But I thought somebody, you know, has to be in that 18% and, you know, whatever it is. And it could be me. And so then a couple of years ago, my internist thought that she felt a lump and we were going through this. And a surgeon here in Ames said, well, why don't you get tested?
And this was the third lump that you'd had checked
mm-hmm.
out because
yeah.
you had
yeah.
been following
sure.
your
yeah.
body so
yeah.
closely.
Yeah. And I you know, at this point, breast cancer, it was not a death sentence. It didn't seem particularly scary. It just seems kind of very something that lots and lots of women have. And so, you know, it was very different in my grandmother's day when I saw my grandmother with her breast cancer, although she did live a long time after her diagnosis. But I was very surprised that, yes, I had this gene, the BRCA1 gene that was endemic to the Ashkenazi Jewish population that would cause me to have a very high percentage of getting breast cancer. I think it was 88%. And also, scarier still, a very high percentage of getting ovarian cancer, over 48%. And that was the real scare to me.
Why was that scarier to you?
Because it's more fatal, it's hard to diagnose. The symptoms of ovarian cancer are symptoms that most people have off and on of, you know, being bloated. It's usually not diagnosed until it's quite late. And so that really scared me.
You write about the moment when you're at the doctor's office waiting for the news about this test, and you sort of have this epiphany realizing, wait a minute, they must want to talk to me because I have the gene, because they would have just called.
Right. That's right. I know. You know, with all my experience with doctors, you know, sometimes you're kind of slow on the uptake. I had the test. I didn't think about it that much. And then they called and said, why don't you come in? And, you know, if they say, why don't you come in, we'll talk to you in person. It's, you know, that's usually not such great news. And I did. And I was surprised. And my husband said he thought he knew. But even the genetics counselor here at Mary Greeley Hospital was surprised because I was older. I was in my early 60s. I had not had any breast cancer. And so I could have been one who didn't have it. And,
right.
Yeah.
When you learned that you were positive for the gene, what went through your head?
Well, I guess I was kind of angry. I thought, you know, I didn't have to have this. You know, I had a child who had a terrible genetic disease. I was pretty pissed off. But I knew I also had to do something and be proactive. I knew it would drive me crazy. I knew I could do not do nothing, even at 62 and 63. And so I decided to have a oophorectomy to remove my fallopian tubes and ovaries, and then to have a double mastectomy. And, you know, it seems crazy when I told people I'm going to do this to my healthy body. It seemed maybe like I was an hysteric, and a lot of people didn't know how to react when you get this, you know, news. And boy, I read a lot. I was online all the time, and it's both good and bad, all of this information that we have on the internet. But I met wonderful women. I talked to people. I was very, very proactive in finding out the information that I needed.
You mentioned the internet, and one of the lines that you write in the book is that you think that the internet should have an off switch at midnight for hypochondriacs and insomniacs.
Right, and pornography enthusiasts, right. It's just like it should just shut off. You know, you shouldn't be on those at night. And, you know, you see pictures of things, you know, late at night. And you can't stop. It's just, you know, one more site. Let me see, you know, one more thing.
Well, and you mentioned that you must have been about 58 years old?
No. When I got the diagnosis, I can't keep – the math is not my strong point, Charity. I'm 66 now. It was 3 years ago. 63.
Okay.
I was diagnosed.
You were going home to Long Island, too, for a reunion about the same time.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I was so looking forward to that. I really kept friends on Long Island through the years, and especially
that's
my...
right. It was a 45th reunion. Mm-hmm. That's where my math got fuzzy.
Yeah,
I kept thinking 40th.
and especially my best friend, Barbara. I've been friends with Barbara since we were 12, and she's very different from me. She would not like to have lived in Iowa, and I loved Iowa the minute I got here. I said, this is for me. It didn't have a lot of traffic, and you didn't have to wear a lot of fancy clothes and have manicures, and people were totally nice and said hi to you all the time. I was a big enthusiast right away. But we stayed friends for all of these years, and I was going to stay at her house. I was going to this reunion, and I got the diagnosis right before the reunion, and that was very hard to go there.
Wow. And the two of you had stayed very close over the years.
Oh, I speak to Barbara probably 3 or 4 times a week.
Wow. That's remarkable.
I know. And she called me 3 or 4 times a day, I think, when we lived near each other. And, you know, we sent our pictures of our grandchildren. And so in some ways, the book is also a testament to women's friendships because she was always, always there for me. Barbara's someone you want to have on your side no matter what. And I feel, you know, very blessed to have had a friendship like this that lasted over 50 years.
And it seems like the two of you lean on each other as if you're family almost. I know that you had lost your mother by this time, but in some ways the involvement that she had when you got the diagnosis of having this gene was almost like a mom.
Well, I want to say, I can say this now because she's not listening. She could drive you crazy, too, because she would go on the
Almost
internet.
Almost like a mom.
She would go on the internet, and she would give me all this advice, and I didn't always agree with her, and she's very, very bossy, as I am, but I would say she's bossier. And so, you know, she was calling me about I should do this and with the double mastectomy and this kind of reconstruction, and I would say, stop, you know, this isn't your body. So we had some hard times with this. And she kept saying, it's your decision. It's totally your decision. And then she'd call me again and say, what about this? What about this doctor? Why don't you come to New York? Why don't you go to Sloan Kettering? She didn't trust that I could have any of these operations in Iowa. You know, maybe she thought we didn't have doctors here or something.
I just do it in the barn.
Right.
When one of the other big things about learning that you had this gene, though, was also, of course, that you have a daughter and you have a granddaughter.
Yes.
And your genetic destiny had already given something to your son that you would have given anything to not have passed along.
Anything.
And now you had to face the fact that perhaps your daughter would have inherited this gene.
For me, that was the hardest thing. That my daughter would carry this legacy. Gabby did not have the gene that caused Zaki's disease.
Right.
And, yeah.
Right. Maybe you could read to us a little bit from your book about when Gabby went to get tested.
Okay. You know, and again, my daughter is very proactive in the way I am. So the minute I found out, she made an appointment to be tested. And she has two young children. And she called me when I was at Barbara's house, Barbara's apartment in New York, right before the reunion. Okay. And this is, I'm in her living room. And Gabby's going to call. I was in Barbara's living room when the phone rang. She looked at the caller ID. "It's Gabby," she said. Our eyes locked across the room. "You pick it up," Barbara said. Gabby could not possibly know already. She was just telling me, calling to say, "Have a great time at the reunion." Still, "Please, please, please," began as a mantra in my head. "Hi, sweetheart," I said, trying to stay upbeat. "Mom?" Gabby's voice is strangled, fraught with emotion. It seems as if she is about to burst out crying. People mix us up on the phone. Like it or not, she has my nasal voice. When I am at her house in Chicago, sometimes my ex calls and I answer. "Hi, hon," he says, his voice soft and loving. I stop him. "This is Fern." I know the "hun" is not meant for me. I cannot make out what Gabby is saying. She's crying. She can't even get the words out. And then I hear, "Great news. I don't have it, Mom. I don't have it. I don't have the gene." "What?" "I don't have it. I don't have the BRCA gene." It is as if what? Words fail me for the happiness born of relief, the exuberant, extraordinary gratitude of nothing happened. Mothers have known this in the most mundane of circumstances. You're at the beach. You put on sunscreen, straighten the blanket. You look into the picnic basket, trying to find the sandwich a child has requested, one without mustard. And then you look up, and suddenly she is not there. You scan the next blanket and the next, down the sand and out into the waves. Terror mounts, the air so close and hot. Panic rises like bile in your throat. You call. You can hardly say her name aloud, for saying it will give the validation that she is missing. Everyone around you is calm. No one is close to fainting the way you are. They don't know. The lapping waves are black, but before the screaming starts, you see her, the tow-headed toddler digging in the sand in the shadow of the next umbrella. And that is the moment when everything is exactly the same as it was before, but different, because your prayer has been answered, and you are at that moment with all your being grateful. Everything is the same as it was. "I don't have it, Mom," Gabby says again. The genetics clinic just called me with the news. I ask her to explain everything, to repeat the conversation exactly. I am aware of Barbara standing next to me, quiet, as I fall to my knees, sobs escaping from a very deep down place.
And that also meant, of course, that your granddaughter does not have
that
the gene.
That is right. That is right. It is a dominant gene, and so it is gone. And because Gabby does not have the gene, which is autosomal recessive, that Zaki doesn't have, that is not going to be, both of those are not going to be passed on to my grandchildren.
They're not in your family's future.
They're not in our family's future. Now, you know, bad things can happen too. You know, yeah, I think it makes you feel more fragile. You cross the street and you can get hit by a car. So it can make you just scared all the time. But those, that's over and that's gone.
You also had your brother get tested.
Yes,
for
I
the
did.
Gene as well.
Yes, I did.
He was a little reluctant to do so, but...
You know, I say when you write a book, it's your book and you own it. And I have to say my brother was not so happy about my revealing his our discussions and his reaction to it. But it was true.
But he also tested negative for the gene.
He tested negative, but he wasn't going to test. He thought I was alarmist. It takes him a while. I mean, I think like most men, it takes a while for him to get it, to think, you know, to think it through.
He's also not listening today, right?
No, no. I'm just going to come clean about, you know, New York. My brother, he's in Oklahoma. I can say anything I want. But he told me not to tell his children. And I said, I'm going to tell them if you don't and if you don't get tested. And so I kind of, you know, bullied him into getting tested.
Because he does have daughters, right?
Yeah, yes, yes. He has a daughter and he has a daughter who's in her 30s and she wants to have children someday and she has to know.
And not only that, but of course it can lead to an increased risk for cancer
sure.
for men as well.
Yes,
so it's,
yes,
it's a very serious situation. We're going to take a short break, Fern, and then we will come back and talk more. I'm talking with Fern Kupfer. She is an author. She is a retired English professor from Iowa State University. Her most recent book is called Leaving Long Island and Other Departures. It's a memoir. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. We've been talking about when she learned that she was positive for BRCA1, a genetic marker for cancer. Do you know someone in your family or are you yourself BRCA positive? We'd love to hear your story as well. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Fern Kupfer. Her most recent book is Leaving Long Island and Other Departures. It's a memoir, and we've been talking about what happened in her life when she discovered that she was positive for the BRCA1 gene, which meant that she had It means that she has a dramatically increased risk for breast and ovarian cancer. She discovered that that gene had not been passed on to her daughter, to her granddaughter, to her niece. And it ends in your family line, Fern, with you. But we haven't talked about what that means for you, because as soon as you discovered that you had this gene, you had to make some very serious decisions for yourself, and you already mentioned that you did go on to have your ovaries removed and also to have a double mastectomy.
Yes.
Once you discovered that you had the gene, how did you explore your options?
Having what's called an oophorectomy, which is a kind of funny word, I just like to say it, oophorectomy, which means taking out your fallopian tubes and ovaries.
It sounds a lot more fun than I'm
yes.
guessing it is.
Actually, for me, it wasn't that bad because I was older, past menopause. I think for a younger woman who discovers that she's going to do these surgeries, that is the most difficult thing, especially if you haven't had children. This was outpatient. Really, it was not, you know, it's not something that's fun, you know, but I think I'd rather do that than a colonoscopy. But it was not a big deal. Having the double mastectomy, taking off two healthy breasts that you like, that you've lived with all your life, was a big deal.
But even with the oophorectomy, you had to decide whether you would get that surgery, whether you would get a hysterectomy. You had options there as well.
I was saying the operation itself was not a big deal. The months of reading and thinking and going here and should I go to this specialist and should I have a gynecological oncologist rather than do it in Ames, Iowa. That was a big deal, and there's so much information. And really, you know, when it comes to it, you own your own body. You do, and you have to make the decision. But that was an easier decision. The double mastectomy was a harder decision emotionally. But again, you know, where should I do it? And then the bigger discussion that I had with so many people and with myself was, should I have reconstructive surgery? I'm having my two healthy breasts removed, and do I have additional surgery and have reconstruction? And I want to say that was a political decision. It's a feminist decision. Everyone had such strong opinions. My friend Barbara, especially my cousins. And eventually I had to do what I felt most comfortable and want to do.
It seems so crazy that, you know, and there are other points in a woman's life where people are very free with advice at times.
Oh, yeah.
When
you're
pregnant.
When
you shouldn't be, for
when you're pregnant and people are feeling your babies. Yeah, yeah.
Right, exactly. But, you know, that so many people felt like they knew exactly what was right. When really, I mean, unless you're actually faced with this, I have a hard time imagining what it would be like.
Right. And what I chose was something that seemed unpopular. I chose to have no reconstruction. I had my breast taken off and I had no reconstruction. And I think a lot of people couldn't understand it. I think a lot of my New York friends, I mean, who have plastic surgery for all sorts of things, couldn't understand it. And I think if I were younger, if I had done this when I was 40, I would have. But, you know, when you're six, I don't want to say like, oh, you know, I was 63, my life is over. That wasn't it at all. I didn't want to have more surgery on my body.
Well,
enough.
You talked to a number of women who'd been through this very same thing and were going to go through it. And you talked to a woman, I believe she had had reconstructive surgery where they had taken the fat from her belly and created breasts using that fat. So it wasn't a silicone implant, which was another option that you could have considered. But and she was very happy with the results, but she'd also spent time in the ICU, in the intensive care unit because of it?
Yeah, she was thrilled with the results. And when I first heard about this operation, I thought, oh, my goodness, that's the best thing. Take your belly fat, that's where I have fat, and just put it right up there and, you know, make breasts. I thought, yeah, that's a great idea.
Sounds like something many of us would like to do.
And it's a serious operation, and it's a hard operation. And you know, Charity, I have seen more breasts of women. Women were so open and so sharing. It was really a wonderful female experience in Ames, Iowa, in Stomping Grounds, in Maud's, in bathrooms, all over Ames. I have seen breasts.
So the women that you would talk to for advice, they would say, well, do you want to see what it looks like?
Absolutely. I mean, one time I was eating lunch in Maud's with three women. You know, women connect in ways that men do. And I think that's such a good and healthy thing. And I was eating lunch with three women in Maud's, two of whom I had never seen before in my life. And the four of us went into the bathroom stall and, you know, opened up our blouses and we all looked at each other. And I'm laughing. I don't know what people who were washing their hands at the sink thought, but it was a really good sharing experience. And so I decided not to. Could I just read you?
Sure.
These are all the reactions that people had because when I decided not to have reconstruction, and I want to say this was not a very strong. I wasn't positive about it. It's like two bad choices. So these are the reactions that people said when I decided this. My husband said, "It's up to you, honey. I just want you to be healthy." My daughter Gabby said, "I am so proud of you, Mom." My cousin Linda said, "I think you will be sorry." Barbara said, "It is totally your decision. Totally, totally. But did you all do any of that reading about the one-step procedure?" Diana said, "Look at me." She had had reconstruction. "And then you can decide later." Jeannie, my Iowa-born neighbor, said, "Oh, of course you wouldn't want to do that." Katie, that's my younger stepdaughter, said, "Now you can just work on your personality." and the reason that she said that was a real kind of gotcha, because when I'd go shopping with her and try on jeans, and, you know, I think that nothing is more difficult than going to a mall with a teenage daughter who's trying on jeans. And she'd say, "How do I look in this? How do I look in this? How does my behind look in this? How do I look in this?" And finally, and I would have bought her anything at that point. And then finally I just said, "You know, just work on your personality." And so she got me back with that one.
Oh my goodness. And so your husband has a wonderful moment with the doctor, and I think you were a little shocked though when the doctor turned to him and said, "Well, how do you feel about this?"
Yes. I mean, it was true. Joe went in with me for one of the exams, and the surgeon said, "How would you feel about being married to a woman without breasts?" And I you know, I was a little shocked by it, and I think, and he was, and he said, well, she would still be Fern. And he has been great. I mean, you know, I think if you have a man that really, really bothers, and that is going to be bereft by being married to someone who has done this surgery, I think maybe then that's the least of your problems.
It's you write about actually a number of moments in life where a man can take a terrible misstep in this process. You had a friend who I believe she was diagnosed with breast cancer while her husband was in Europe.
Yes.
He said, do you want me to come home?
Right.
And she said, well, only if you want to. And of course he came.
But it was too late.
Right.
She
never forgave him for even asking.
You don't, right. Poor, so, you know, we don't
this
know.
Is, it's
poor
a
guys.
It's a minefield for men as well, though.
But I have met women, and actually this is very sad, whose husbands could not get over this. I mean, I just think, like, who are these guys? I have met women, I was very connected. I went to the FORCE conference, which is for women who are BRCA positive. And I met this beautiful young woman, and she was getting divorced. She was just diagnosed with the BRCA gene. And it made her husband too sad, and he just couldn't see her in the same way anymore. And they got divorced. So sometimes, you know, this kind of tragedy does tear people apart rather than bring them together.
Your daughter had a wonderful line from before you went through all of this,
yeah.
Because you mentioned that you'd had two cesarean sections,
yeah.
So you had scars from that,
yeah.
And you had two benign lumps removed,
yeah.
And one night she was in the room with you while you were getting undressed. And why don't you tell us what she said?
Oh, I had scars from the lumps being removed, but I had not had the mastectomy yet. And I had said, oh, you know, how am I going to look? And my daughter said, Mom, you have a very nice body and those scars make you look experienced. And so the idea of scars, you know, being a kind of a badge of honor. It's like, hey, I'm still here, and I've had experience.
Right, right. Which a lot of us have had.
Yeah.
At this point in your life, you are very happily married. We haven't talked about your first marriage, which you write quite a bit about in
yes.
this book, and you have written quite a bit about before, and you mentioned how it's nice to have the final word. I'm sure that that's been very nice as a writer.
Yes, it is. I used to tell my students, Charity, you know, I taught writing, I taught memoir writing, and, you know, when you were writing about, you know, an alcoholic uncle or someone who abused you or something, you know, I said, you have to face the consequences of this. You will make some enemies. Some people will not speak to you again. But I've always said to my students, this is your story to tell. And you tell the truth about your own life. And if someone else doesn't want it, well, you know, he or she can write his own book. So it can give you pause, but I think you have to you have to tell the truth as you see it. It's your story.
Right now, with the process you went through to write this book, and you included quite a few pictures in the book, which
yeah.
were wonderful, and I'm so glad you did.
Thank you. You know, I just it seems a little self-aggrandizing to put all, you know, your family pictures in a book. But I know from my own experience, when I read a memoir, I like pictures, and I'm always going back and forth. You know, someone, you mentioned a character or a child, and going back and looking
yes.
at the pictures. I'm always disappointed in a memoir when there's no pictures. So that was a lot of fun, going through old family albums, peeling them off, you know, putting in, you know, what I wanted to put in.
Looking at these pictures, I mean, not only were you exploring who you were in 1964.
Yeah.
But you were looking at her and
yeah.
really trying to get intimately reacquainted with that Fern.
Yes, yes.
And what was that process like for you? Are you the same Fern? Can you see it? Can you feel
it? Oh, yeah. I think so. I mean, I had a really nice childhood. I always had friends. you know, I was popular in school. So in that sense, it was charmed. And then, you know, when I was an adult, it was like, ooh, boom, boom, boom. You know, really, really hard, bad stuff. Yeah. And so I don't know if coming from a really happy, solid, stable, loving family grounded me to prepare for this. I never in my life thought, maybe I was stupid, I never thought really bad things was going to work, anything bad was going to happen to me, because I felt protected. So when I look at that young girl, that happy girl, you know, I think, oh, I'm still her. I am. And then, you know, when I went back to my high school reunion, it was after Zachy was diagnosed and people knew about him and I had written about him. And one girl I went to high school with said, oh, you were always such a happy girl. And I wanted to say, you know, I still am. That person is still me.
You seem very content at this point in your life. Is that a true impression?
Well, it's not totally. I'm not content every day. It's not totally true. And I think, you know, one of the things that you feel when you're 66 is, ooh, you know, time is that chariot is really running. And, you know, you put in a new tree in the backyard and you want it to be a fast growing tree. So that is the, you know, I don't want to say cloud, but certainly you're dopey if you're 66 years old and you think, oh, I have a big, big stretch ahead of me. Yeah, I think of that. You know, you have to think of that, which I didn't used to when I was young. But on the other hand, you know, there's a real freedom in being 66. You know, I can say whatever I want. I don't care.
You wrote a list in the book of all the things that you have not done yet in retirement, like walk dogs at the animal shelter and play golf and a number of things.
Yeah, yeah.
You wrote this book, and you said you're not a person who needs to write. Are you still writing? Is there something else that you need to do?
I need to have friends. I need to talk on the phone. I need to talk to the kids. I need to go to nice dinner parties and eat good food. I don't have a compelling desire to do something else. I might write. I've been writing a little for my hometown, for the Ames Tribune, and I do that once a month. And that's been, you know, kind of fun. I wrote a column for years for Newsday. So I have something to say. I have opinions. So I think my husband is very happy that I started writing again, you know, columns, because then I don't have to just tell him all my opinions after we read the paper.
Oh, I'll bet
morning.
You have to try them out on him.
Yeah, yes, he's a very good listener.
And something else an impression that I had from the book,
yeah,
is that although, as you mentioned, you carry your heritage in your accent, in your nasal passages,
yeah,
I think
it's
what you said. It sounds like you feel like you're an Iowan.
I think I'm an honored guest. I love the landscape of Iowa. I like the flatness. I like the big sky. When my husband and I visited the state of Washington, and we both said, ooh, too many trees. You know, you feel claustrophobic there. So I like the Iowan people. I don't feel quite like I fit in, though, even after 41 years here.
Well, we're happy to have you
thank
here,
you
Fern.
So much.
Fern Kupfer, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Fern Kupfer's most recent book is Leaving Long Island and Other Departures, a memoir. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Alyssa Weiss. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.